this right? It's on power off.
Hi, welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speakers are Brad Benoit and Anne Palmerton. They will be doing a session entitled Evil is Not a Problem, Wheat and the Weeds. So let's listen in.
This is the continuing morning Bible study series on the parables, foretaste of the feast to come. Today we are tackling the parable of the wheat and the weeds from Matthew chapter 13 under the heading of evil is not a problem. It is something, and we'll get to that later, but we just want to suggest that at this point it's not a problem. I'm Brad Benoit. I'm on the faculty at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio.
And I'm Anne Palmerton, married to Brad, an associate pastor at Broad Street Presbyterian Church in downtown Columbus, Ohio. So welcome to this session. Let us begin with prayer from this book, Gorillas of Grace. You may be familiar with it, by Ted Loader. The prayer I'll be reading is, "Drive me deep to face myself." Let us pray. Lord, grant me your peace, for I have made peace with what does not give peace, and I am afraid. Drive me deep now to face myself, so I may see that what I truly need to fear is my capacity to deceive and my willingness to be deceived, my loving of things and using of people, my struggle for power and shrinking of soul, my addiction to comfort and sedation of conscience, my readiness to criticize and reluctance to create, my clamor for privilege and silence at injustice, my seeking for security and forsaking the kingdom. Lord, grant me your peace. Instill in me such fear of you as will begin to make me wise, and such quiet courage as will enable me to begin to make hope visible, forgiving delightful, loving contagious, faith liberating, peacemaking joyful, and myself open and present to other people and your kingdom. Amen. Evil is not a problem, it is a... We want to provide some food for thought and conversation as we fill in the blank today, and hope that you'll go with us as this parable that we have known as the wheat and the tares, that is now spoken of as the wheat and the weeds, unfolds. So if you'd like to turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 13, kind of give you the setting for this, and then we'll read the parable. The first parable in this chapter is the parable of the sower, a parable about the planting of the word, about the beginning of the realm of God. And Jesus tells this story, this parable, and then follows it with kind of an allegorical interpretation, an explanation of what it means. The planting of the word, the beginning of the realm of God. And then in verse 24, we read, "He," Jesus, "put before them another parable." And the Greek there suggests this putting before them another parable is the same language used to place before someone a banquet or a feast. So the imagery really fits in with our theme for all of this. He placed before them something else to feast on, to chew on. A parable not about beginnings, but about results and conclusions.
Want me to read this?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the tasty morsel for the day then. Chew on this. Matthew chapter 13, it's verses 24 through 30. "Another parable he put before them, saying, The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men or people were sleeping..." Now here's where it gets interesting. The RSV says, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat. If you're reading out of the New Revised Standard, it says, an enemy came. Here's an attempt, I think, at inclusive language, which betrays the purpose maybe just a little bit. It probably should still be his. That's not an exclusive term. If you think of the farmer as male, however, if the farmer is female, then it should be her enemy. The point is, it's the personal enemy of the farmer somehow, not just a vaguely described enemy. But also notice, it's not in language that sometimes elsewhere in the New Testament is used to say the enemy. So figure out what that means in the by and by here. In any event, his enemy came, I'm reading from the Revised Standard, and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, the weeds appeared also. And the servants of the householder came and said to him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then has it weeds? He said to them, an enemy has done this. Now back to that language. The servants said to him, then do you want us to go and gather them? But he said, no, lest in the gathering the weeds you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow up together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn. End of story. Want to say also this morning, thank you to those who are here to interpret with American Sign Language for us as we continue a week of emphasis. Appreciating the gifts of those who are deaf and hard of hearing, who are teaching us how to speak in a different way, and we're learning all kinds of good signs this week. So glad to have that be a part of what we're feasting on, too. Let's see. Okay. What's this lesson? I mean, what's Jesus getting into here in this lesson? What's this parable all about? We would like you to try to entertain with us for a little while the thought that evil is not a problem. That's kind of shocking. What can that possibly mean? I think it was certainly shocking for those who first heard this parable as they began to try to figure out what Jesus was saying. But run with it a little bit and let's see where we can go. I'm imagining that one of the reasons this is a bit of an arresting thought is if you ever read the front page of the daily paper, there it is. Bosnia, Chechnya, you name it. I mean, there's just such a long litany of global problems, evil poking through, tearing the world apart. And that's not even counting just the local stuff you see on your metro page, you know, the run-of-the-mill murders and child abuse and domestic violence and government corruption and whatever, let alone all that kind of thing. So maybe it is shocking to entertain this thought that Jesus is saying evil is not a problem, but we want to try to define that in a certain kind of a way here and see if we can do that. Evil's not a problem in the sense that we so typically think about problems. Evil is not a problem in the sense of being like a math problem. You remember those algebra problems you had to do back in, you know, ninth grade or whatever. It's not a problem if we think of a problem as something that lends itself to a solution. You know, you work it through, you get the answer, there's one way to solve it, fix it, make it right, whatever. Evil is not a problem in the sense of, say, having a health problem, that if you get proper diagnosis, proper treatment, proper medication, surgery, physical therapy, whatever, you get it fixed, and then you're back to where you were before it ever happened and everything's fine. Evil is not that kind of a problem. There's no, at least short of the kingdom of God, there is no solution, no cure for evil. Hasten to add here, I don't want to be heretical, we are not in any way trying to say that evil is not real, that evil is not a problem in the sense of being an issue that causes us great pain. It's horrendous, it's terrifying, it's the dark side of the universe, it's corrosive. It's the heart of everything that's wrong with our individual and corporate lives. All we want to launch here is the notion that, that evil is nothing as simple as a problem that has a solution. It is much more textured than that, as I think we'll begin to see as we work through the parable. So it's not a problem, but it is some other things, maybe.
And we would like to suggest that throughout history, Christians haven't always had this in perspective.
No kidding.
Because evil has been thought of as a problem to be solved. And we can look back at some critical historical events and see how that's played out. Evil infidels should be driven from the Holy Land. And the result is the Crusades. Right. Evil heretics should be driven from the church. And the result is the Inquisition. Demon rum should be banished from North America. The result is prohibition. Right. And in our own, later in our own century, godless communists, right, can be destroyed. And the result? Korea, Vietnam, the Cold War, the arms race,
McCarthyism.
Right. We seek a solution and we end up with Legion. Drugs are a problem in our neighborhoods. So we seek a solution. We build more jails. There are more police officers on the street. And there it is. Evil doesn't fit into our understanding of how the world should work. And as Christians who struggle with the nature of God, God's power, God's goodness, where does evil fit into all of this? Obviously, it's an age-old question. Evil's tough to explain. And things we can't explain frustrate us, embarrass us. And so the germs of thought we're suggesting that eventually blossom into the Crusades, the Inquisition, war, grow well in this soil of embarrassment and frustration.
Well, yeah, I wanted to go back to something somebody said in the first session this morning when we were running through some of these examples. A person said, you know, the first thing I thought of was affirmative action. Well, that's kind of interesting. He said, you know, was this an example of where we thought we were going to root out this problem of racism, and here was the solution and the way to do it? Well, you know, it's obviously there can be some sensitive thoughts about this, I know, but I began to think about that, and I think the issue there is, do you see affirmative action as the solution, in which case maybe it is an unfaithful response to the kind of problem it's meant to address, or can you see affirmative action as a way to work on the problem? No pretense that this is going to be the thing that solves this once and for all, but it's one way to manage the dilemma of the evil of racism. It's not everything that's called for, but it's a coping strategy. It's on the way to working toward an ever more fruitful solution. I think it all depends, as we're going to suggest in other ways, it all depends on what your mindset is as you begin to look at and work with evil. Is it, in fact, our within the realm of our possibilities in this life, to root out and eradicate evil? Or are we simply called to work against it faithfully, staying free of the pretense that we can ever get the job done this side of, you know, the coming of God's reign in fullness? So that may be interesting to think about something like affirmative action and what really is the mindset we bring to it and what are its intended, what do we intend for that to accomplish. It may indeed be, I think, something evil if it becomes a way to address the problem of racism but does not get us engaged in going after deeper systemic problematic causes for racism, a kind of fix, you know, a nice tight solution on what really is a very difficult, messy, and even evil problem. Well, I want to jump back just from some of these more recent examples, go back to the early church for a second, just to surface how maybe the context of Jesus telling this parable, but highlight the fact that evil was a really a very real issue in the first century or so of the church as well. The first followers of Jesus also wanted very much to solve the problem of evil. And this may have had a lot to do with the early connections of Judaism and Christianity, especially as influenced by the Pharisees. In Jesus' day, the Pharisees were the largest sect within Judaism, sort of the theological driving force. And the predominant piece of theological thinking in the sect of the Pharisees was that the Messiah would come when the Torah, when God's law, was perfectly kept in the community of believers. Now you can begin to see the path down which this takes you. If the only way that the kingdom is finally going to come is when the law gets perfectly kept, you have to get rid of those people who are incapable or are unwilling to keep Torah perfectly. So the definition of who is a true believer gets narrower and tighter and smaller and more carefully defined. Now, you may know, this parable is not found in Mark's gospel. Here it is in Matthew. Well, why is that? Most people would agree that Matthew or Mark's gospel was probably the first gospel written down. Well, Mark and Matthew wrote for different audiences. And it's probably the case that Matthew made sure to include this parable of Jesus in his gospel because his audience was largely a group of Jewish Christians. Now, in the first century, Christians still had a large Jewish kind of identity. Typically, they would go to synagogue on Saturday and church on Sunday. You know, do the Torah business on Saturday and Eucharist on Sunday. And for a while, that went together until it began to be clear the distinctiveness of what it meant to be a Christian. But there was this understandable tendency that began to carry over about the purity of the community being important. If indeed Jesus was Messiah and the kingdom was coming, maybe it really was important to have a pure community. Well, Matthew seems to be sure that this parable gets kept in front of the community so as to remind them that indeed this is a new age and a new vision for the reign of God that Jesus has inaugurated. Probably enough said about that. Hope that's... Yeah?
I've always heard that the Christians were expelled from the synagogue at some point in history, whereas you said that they realized the distinctiveness of Christianity. That's quite a different interpretation. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, my wife reminded me of this yesterday, too.
That's
the same thing she said. Hey, wait a minute, wasn't it? And I think it's a both-and situation.
The parable would have meant a lot more to them if they had been expelled, so, in a sense. Because they would have experienced what it meant to be thought of as evil.
Rooted out.
Right.
And kicked out.
But I think it's equally true that in the very earliest stages of the church, Christians themselves were having to think this out. And that they were somewhat rooted in both communities. And then there was a decisive break and then things began to fall out more clearly. I see it a little more as a both and rather than a one way or the other. I mean, I think they're both true. And you can see the parable one way or the other. I'm no Matthean expert. It's fun to do Bible study when you're not a biblical theologian, because then you can just say, I don't know. You know, talk to my colleagues. But that's my basic understanding of that.
Okay. Right. Evil is not a problem. It's a mystery. Okay? It's not a mystery in the sense of Murder, She Wrote. If you like that show on TV, you know that Jessica always gets the mystery solved in the last 10 minutes of the show. In that case, the word mystery is something to be solved. There's a solution or an answer to it. But we're talking about evil as a mystery in the sense of its impenetrableness. It keeps growing, and you can't get to the bottom of it. You enter into it, and it keeps going somewhere beyond you. It's one of those mysteries, one of those great mysteries of life. So we're suggesting that those kinds of mysteries, this kind of mystery, is best ultimately left in the hands of God. And that what Jesus was trying to get the people to see as he told the parable was that maybe our natural or our knee-jerk reaction to evil is to circle the wagons, right? To carefully define who's in and who's out, keep the good ones in, kick the bad ones out. And Jesus is saying, we suggest that that's God's work, and that it's our tendency to want to do God's work faster than God.
Which is one of the basic manifestations of human evil, is to confuse the distinction between creature and creator, and forget where we properly belong in that relationship. Against this kind of backdrop, here's Jesus with a parable that presents a pretty arresting alternative to seeing yourselves in a God-like role where your job is to fix the problem of evil. And Jesus does it in language that pretty much everybody of his day and time would have understood. It's a little more remote from us since we're not, by and large, an agricultural community, but to this group of people who lived close to the land, images about farming, would have tied right in. He sets up the story and says there's wheat that's been planted. That's good, wholesome, healthy, grain, nourishing, so forth. And then there's this weed, the name of which in the Greek here is a weed called darnel, which was a particularly insidious weed. Genius choice of image, because this is exactly the nature of evil. It looked a lot like wheat. Same kind of shaft, same color. Grew to about the same height. On a quick glance, you couldn't tell them apart. Maybe the really expert farmer could sort them out, but most people couldn't. What Jesus said then, by way of the parable, is that when the farmer's servants want to go out and rip out the weeds, he says, no, be careful. If you uproot the weeds, you will also uproot the wheat. They grow so closely together, you can't take one without taking the other. Now, it gets even a little more complicated than just the farming imagery here. Even if you were an expert farmer and could tell the two apart, that's one thing. None of us, I don't think, should presume that we are skilled enough to be able to distinguish good and evil people, even if we can say that there are people who are all evil and all good. That's problematic in and of itself. You really ought to stay out of the field lest you do more harm than good. The real point is that just as the wheat and the weeds grow up side by side, practically with roots wrapped around one another, in the same soil. The truth of the human situation is that evil and good grow in the same life. It was Alexander Solzhenitsyn who said during the Cold War period that the line between good and evil is not drawn between East and West, but the line between good and evil runs straight down the middle of every human heart. And I should tell you that The place that I first heard that quote was from the lips of the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church when I was in Moscow, 1982. That was a very riveting moment. To have that church leader in that context say, this is what we must realize, that evil is a very big problem because it exists in the smallness of each one of our own individual lives. So if you go out trying to rip out evil from the world, you're going to rip your own heart out because that's partly where it's rooted. The good baby goes right out with the despicable bathwater in this sense. It's in part why nuclear weapons were such a lousy way to try to attack the problem of evil. They're very indiscriminate. You know, a lot of good stuff gets blown up along with the bad stuff. And even in an era when we're so enamored with our so-called smart bombs, you know, you can just practically go knock on the right door and find this evil person, it still, in a theological sense, is very problematic. Because rooted in every human life is good and evil wrapped around one another. Push on.
Well, thank goodness it's not the amount of good or evil in us that makes us fit for the kingdom, fit for God's realm or not. Thanks be to God for that. Since the line between good and evil goes through every human heart, none of us are, quote, fit to be a part of this realm. What makes us fit for the realm is what God does, who God is, and the sense of trusting in that God, that God will deal graciously with us. And so to the extent that others have this trust, that's not something that we can necessarily ferret out, that we can necessarily know. It's a mystery, and that mystery, we're suggesting, is on God's side, not on ours.
I think you're probably going to get to this sooner or later, but I'm just getting a little anxious thinking, well, okay, it's a mystery.
I know, we need to cut to
the... You got it, you can't fight it, so just sit around and let it happen. What do we do with the evil that we encounter in our own hearts or out there in the community? And also it seems like there's some evils, maybe less personal evils, like diseases, polio, smallpox, where actually there was a solution to. But in any case, getting back to more personal, people stuff.
Glad you ask. What is our task? I got that up here. Our task. And again, try not to make this overly simplistic, but I think what we're urging here is the cultivation of a mindset to suggest that it is faithful and appropriate to struggle against evil, as I think you're suggesting. We should do that. It's inappropriate and unfaithful to get ourselves in the position where we begin to believe that we can solve and eradicate evil. And that's a pretty finely nuanced distinction, but in a sense, life and death hang on our ability to get that straight. So, what's our task? What are we suggesting? I think the point is that when we look at the field out there, we are being called to focus more on the wheat than the weeds. Now, that is not to say that we totally ignore the weeds. They're there. We're aware of them. We take account of what the impact of evil is in the world and so forth. But we're not supposed to obsess about the weeds either. Now, think of the story and where these servants of the farmer are. These people are obsessed about these weeds. Oh my God, there's weeds in the field. What are we going to do? They're going to grow up, they're choke out the wheat. This is terrible. We got to get them out of there. They're going to have an apoplectic fit here. the farmer says, no, no, no. Now look, I know they're there. Of course this isn't good. But let's think this through, fellas. You go out there all hyperactive, ripping out weeds, you're going to make things worse. You know? Let's think about this. So it's about mindset. The wheat is the most important thing. Should never lose sight of that. If we begin to feel that the weeds are the more powerful part of the equation here, that's where we begin to get into trouble. We give the weeds more due than they deserve. And we get fixated. I'm sorry, yes.
Was that D-E-W?
D-U-E. Yes, D-U-E. Thank you. Yes. Yes. D-O?
Yeah, that's what she did. That's what she did.
Right. Again, evil is important, but it's not more important than the gospel.
Can we talk about some examples of weeds?
Yeah.
I've got lots of things going on in my mind, and I'm just wondering.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good place. Jump in. What? Throw some out
well,
so we can.
Well, the weeds in my life are kids in my daughter's school that haven't been raised with very strong values.
Mm-hmm.
And there are probably more weeds than wheat in her school.
Mm-hmm.
And I concentrate on the weeds because I want to be helpful to those kids that don't know what's right and wrong.
Right.
So I'm involved in the PTA and I do all these things to try to help the weeds become more wheat-like. And I don't know if that's what you're contributing
yeah.
to.
Let me see if I can just reframe that in terms of this parable, because I think you may not be doing, in fact, what you just said. It's not a matter of changing weeds into wheat. What I hear you saying is you're trying to help the wheat grow to its most full capacity given the nasty, weedy environment you've got to work in. And I think that's very faithful and is very appropriate for what we should be doing. I think our calling is to nourish, cultivate, help grow the good fruit in the soil that's there. And recognize, you know, if there's an opportunity here and there to pull a weed, terrific. You know, let's try to do it. But let's not get so carried away with the weeding operation that we're going to pull up a lot of wheat in the process. Somebody else in the first session mentioned that as a child he got the task of weeding the garden, and he said, in addition to my liability of being colorblind, where I couldn't always tell which was which, you know, there was just a certain also clumsiness about being a child where you grabbed and, well, that's pretty much the spiritual state of all of us. In a sense, we're all colorblind, not able to see the fine distinctions between good and evil. And we're all, in a sense, spiritually clumsy and not really as capable as the spirit is of knowing which is where. So what all I'm suggesting is it's more our calling to cultivate the wheat. You know, deal with the weeds as you can, but not to get so obsessed with them that we begin to do damage. Now, we talked about this in the first hour, too. I think this is one of the fundamental problems with those on the religious right who want to pack every organization from the local school board to the Supreme Court with people who are ideologically sympathetic. There is an obsession with the weeds. And a beginning to be a neglect of the wheat, I think, anyway. So that the attempt to get purity, you see, at all levels of government and church and institution, you can talk about your own denomination here if you want. That's the one I'm holding, if you know what's going on in the Presbyterian Church.
Begins to
be very damaging. Yeah,
I wanted to respond to your question, too, because one thing the parable doesn't deal with is the ability. It breaks down at the level of where the weeds can be transformed into wheat. That's not possible given the parameters of this parable. But with kids in a school setting,
that possibility of human transformation is there.
But see, I would say it's not that we are wheat or weeds. Mm-hmm. We are the soil, mm-hmm. you know, and what fruit will our soil bring, you know. Another image.
I'm seeing this problem in some congregations of the ELCA now in terms of deciding whether or not to continue in the ELCA because they can't make it what they think it ought to be. And so they're deciding to get out of the ELCA and get into some organization where things are more the way they think it ought to be.
Right.
And this saddens me too, because when I talk to these people, they're not sure, of course, how it's going to end up. And I try to tell them you're probably going to find as many problems in that group as you have in this group.
Susan?
Just thinking about that, my husband's motto for his life is, of all the options we're given, the only one we do not have is perfection. And I think that in the school situation, I see parents increasingly pulling their children out of public schools that seem so greedy, and putting them in parochial or private schools as if you're going to there find the soil that only grows wheat. I mean, it's that old desire to get back to Eden somehow, as if we could pick exactly the right people to be with, whether it's in a community or a school setting or a denominational setting, until you know, we're back to Adam almost accusing God of creating Eve and messing the whole thing up, because if he'd had the garden alone, he could have been blameless and righteous and innocent all those days. I think there's that desire in all of us to try to create a perfect little garden where the soil only grows wheat, and then we don't admit the weeds that are in ourselves, as if it's that desire for perfectionism, which finally isn't an option we're given.
Yeah. And back to what Anne was saying, it is so embarrassing, deeply embarrassing, to have to admit that I can't be perfect. I just don't like that. And that's when I get off on these crusades, literally, of evil doing. I think, in terms of the ELCA and denominations and so forth, I mean, there is a place, and history has furnished us with examples, of where people needed to leave the current religious structure and reconstitute, reform, do something else. And I think there are times when that's legitimate. The point is, exactly as you're suggesting, Norlin, do we labor under the illusion that by doing that we will get back to Eden and create perfection? Or do we simply, or is it a mindset that says it's not going to be perfect over here, but we simply have to be clear about where we stand and put some distance between us and this? You know, let's just make the move. It has everything to do with this rather subtle ability to stay free of the belief that I can create perfection in the here and now. You know, there may be sometimes reasons to distance ourselves from certain school policies and so forth, but we have to ask, why are we doing that? And is it out of the utter frustration because we can't make it perfect? We think we can do that if we could just, you know, get a clean start over here. I don't think so. Again, in the first hour, someone mentioned the issue of abortion, that she saw that those who advocate right to life, at least in some elements of that faction, have now, you know, we have this curious phenomena of doctors getting shot. Well, the desire to eradicate evil is turned perversely around into the perpetuation of more evil. Now, that's certainly not true of that movement totally and so forth, but it's a small example of how this can just manifest itself in such a terrible, terrible way. It's a little bit like, I mean, I like to deal with family of origin issues and so forth. If our attempts to be unlike evil becomes too desperate, what we end up being is just like evil. It's like if you grow up with parents who did things one certain way, and you say, I am never going to parent my children the way that my parents parented me. I don't ever want to be that way. I am not going to do that. And you wake up one day realizing that, yes, you've structured your whole life differently, but you are not free. You didn't make your own choice to be that kind of parent. Your parents are still controlling you. I mean, it's your strong desire to be so unlike them that you're now this way. That is not exercising your God-given gift to make some free choices. And that's why when we get so fixated on the weeds, we give up our freedom to work creatively with the wheat and make good and creative things happen. In the end, then, evil still controls us, if we're so fixated on fighting against it.
That happens personally, too, when you fixate on your problems and your emotional... You know, some people spend their whole lives looking back on their childhood or their what's gone wrong before, rather than saying the weeds are there, but we have to try and work with the weeds that we have within ourselves. Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is like this, not the world is like this. How do you think about it in terms of that?
This is Ann's mom who's asking the question. Maybe you might ask
the question. You're the one who sent your daughter to seminary. Oh, that's true. Okay.
We shouldn't try to be rooting out these people we think of as weeds. You know, we should grow together, and it's God's work to handle that at the end. So we don't have to worry about that so much as we have to worry about our weed growth.
Well, I think we have to get to the end of the parable. I mean, your Presbyterian dollars put me through Princeton Seminary, so here I'll tell you what I think. Don't misunderstand me. That's a huge thank you from a Lutheran who's very grateful for the Presbyterians at Princeton Seminary. Often Jesus introduces parables and says, the kingdom of God, or in Matthew it's usually the kingdom of heaven, is like. And what he almost never means is that the kingdom of heaven is like this or that thing, but rather the kingdom of heaven is like this process that I'm now going to describe to you. It's not that the kingdom of heaven is like a farmer or like a seed. It's that the kingdom of heaven is like this process of growing and harvesting. And I think the end of the parable here is where he comes to that then, to say the kingdom of heaven is like this business of letting it grow up together and letting God do the sorting out at the harvest time. So it's a combination of this life and the next, this world and the coming kingdom, and not just one or the other. Does that make some sense?
Well, what I was thinking was there's a distinction between the kingdom of heaven and the world.
Does this
apply more specifically to folks that are close in the kingdom of heaven, or at least going in that direction?
No, because I think Jesus is saying the kingdom of heaven is breaking into this world in everywhere, just popping up all over the place. So the two are coming to a full intersection at that point of the ultimate harvest, when things will be distinguished and separated, and we will finally know, if ever, that's the only time we'll know, where the weeds and where the wheat really are, what shakes out.
Now, my translation says...
Others may help here, yeah.
The harvest workers are the ones who make the separation, and
yes,
not God.
Well, Jesus even says later in the chapter, the disciples then get him off to the side and say, now what are you talking about? Tell us what this means. And he takes them through, and I think there he even says distinctly the angels are the
reapers.
The reapers. But biblically, when the angel imagery is very hard to distinguish from the actual power of God. These are the heavenly hosts who serve God so intimately that whenever you see angels doing something, you can rest assured that is exactly what God wants done. So that's not a human agency of separation, but truly a divine work. But there were some other hands and comments here, and however we can help unfold Marta's question too, which is a good one.
In the back. I just wanted to ask, with the end of this parable, I'm just wondering for your interpretation. This doesn't, does this negate universalism in your view? Or it's not, this isn't like the fundamentalist view of the evil people are going to burn in hell, or is it just that the evil itself is going to be destroyed? And some people see this as if there's no way universalism could be supported and used as text for it. Is that not true? I'm just wondering.
Good question.
Thank you, honey. Thank you.
Or we can talk about that later.
You're the specialist on sovereignty of God and predestination. All these Lutherans just interested in gospel.
We should study verses 36 through 43. Where Jesus interprets.
Yeah,
right.
I'll give you my short form answer to that, which is, I'm partly of two minds, but I'll tell you what Robert Capon thinks, who I think is a pretty interesting interpreter of parables. In more than one parable, he seems to leave open the possibility that, you know, God excludes no one from the kingdom. If it's the case that people miss out on the banquet, it's because they decide they don't need it and don't want it. And his archetypal parable for that is the wedding feast where the fellow gets in without a garment. I think I mentioned this yesterday. And then the master of the feast says, what are you doing here? You don't have a wedding garment on. Out with you into outer darkness and so forth. The point being that here was a person who did not want to accept the graciousness of the person hosting the banquet, thought he was good enough in and of himself that he didn't need that. And so if there's exclusion, it's the exclusion, it's us perpetuating the wrongheadedness that we don't need grace, and that the wrath of God is not God being small-minded and mean-spirited, but rather the reaction God has when we say no to grace. I mean, you know what that's like when you try to help someone and they say, I don't need this. And you say, why? I can't do anymore. I mean, I did everything, you know. That's at least one way to look at it, but it is a much more complicated issue than that, of course.
Well, it could be like what you were suggesting before, Krishna, where there are weeds and wheat in each one of our hearts, and at the last day, the weeds will be thrown into the fire. The evil in our hearts will be cast out, and the good in us will be redeemed.
Right.
Or whatever.
Because only God can do that kind of surgery,
right,
without killing us,
right,
in a sense. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I have a question for Pastor Ann. Since you're in a congregation is not the realm of God, but it should reflect something of the realm of God. In line with this parable, would there ever be a time when you, as a pastor, would advise your congregation not to accept someone as a member, or possibly even to exclude someone who already is a member? That's rather far-fetched. But suppose somebody came. Oh, no? Okay.
Well, I mean, no, it's not far-fetched?
It's not
far-fetched.
Okay. A conversation that Brad and I just shared the other day had to do with exactly this. Before I started the call that I've just begun, I was in another congregation near Ohio State University, and there was a family in the church who were incredibly antagonistic. And, you know, Ken Houck's book, Antagonists in the Church, some of you are familiar with that, the kind of people who really are the weeds. very difficult to deal with, always harassing, stirring up things, making life very difficult. And there were many times when I would have liked to disinvite them, really, from the life of the church because of the seeds they were sowing. What happened over time was that they disinvited themselves and moved to another congregation, kind of, you know, hoping that the grass would be greener. Certainly to find other issues.
But I was thinking more of people who, either because of a totally different belief structure or a pattern of life that might not be acceptable to some of your members or something like that, that the issue might be a scandal of one kind or another.
Right.
Would you ever on that basis say, this is a weed, or would you say that's for God to decide?
Oh, I think, yeah. Our Presbyterian denomination has a book of order, which is this much lower than the Bible. I mean, we're... and,
I long for a book of order. So. Yeah.
But a book of order has several pieces, and one is a book of discipline. And there we have within our structure the ability to discipline someone in the life of the church. Now, nowadays, that's invoked rarely, if ever. The Orthodox Presbyterian denomination does invoke that. And for instance, over issues of morality, we'll call someone in front of the congregation, lay out what they've done, whether it's adultery, some kind of abuse, whatever, and the congregation will censure that person. You know, I mean, that's stuff that we have in our book, but we haven't acted upon it.
We have congregations in San Francisco that are living on the edge now because they're being disciplined for some actions that they took.
With the ordination.
And the next convention will have to decide whether they will be excluded or whether they'll continue working with them.
I would say, for me, a former parish pastor, with one of my former parishioners here, I'd be much more reticent on the issue of disciplining members simply because discerning adequately where wheat and weeds are growing is a very tough thing. On the issue of people's affiliating with the fellowship, I think we ought to be willing to say, there is a certain required confessional stance to mark yourself as part of this fellowship. And it's not pointing fingers or calling people bad and evil to say that's not where you are. It's simply saying, let's be realistic and clear about what we stand for. Let's let the church be a professing, confessing church. You can hold lots of beliefs and call yourself lots of things, but please don't use the label of Christian for that when truly it doesn't conform to the basic tenets of what Christianity is all about. And that list is actually a very short list of basic things. You can count them on one hand, practically. But we need to be, I think, enough of a confessing church that folks will begin to, in effect, sort themselves out. If we're clear about who we are, folks will not want to affiliate with us for the wrong reasons. This was part of the forum last night, if you were here, trying to figure out what the church should and shouldn't be. And we came back to saying, if it's one holy Catholic apostolic church and we're clear about what that means, things do begin to sort themselves out. And we don't look like the Rotary Club.
Yeah. I don't think we should think that all, Lutherans, even more than Presbyterians, are afraid of discipline. But I don't think we should be afraid of all kinds of discipline always, because the purpose is to bring the person back into the fellowship.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. From when I was serving a parish in Detroit, Michigan many years ago, and one of my colleagues in ministry was also the pastor of a mixed black and white congregation, and there was a white member of the church, a woman who was sowing seeds of discord, racist seeds of discord within her own congregation because of her racist attitudes. And it was just a continuing pattern of, just putting down black members of the church and acting as if the white members were all superior to the black members. And so finally, my friend who was the pastor there at the time had to, of course we don't like the word because we have bad associations with it, but all it means is that he said that she could not commune. He said he excommunicated her, which is the word that we don't like, but all it meant was that not that she wasn't a member, not that they weren't working for her to be in fellowship and love within the congregation, but that for the time being, until she repented of her racist discord, her racist behavior within that congregation, divisive behavior, that she would not be welcome to receive communion at the altar. And she, the end of the story is interesting too and significant, because she didn't come to the Lord's table at her congregation, although she continued to worship there, for a couple of months, and it worked. Finally, she came to the pastor and said, I want to confess my sins. I realized that you were right. I was wrong, and this, my behavior was sinful, and I want to receive absolution. And she did. And the behavior changed, and it made a tremendous difference in the life of the congregation.
It sounds faithful to me to Matthew 18, which, if you know, about what do you do when there's a problematic element in the fellowship and you get some people to go talk and talk some more. And the end of that, Jesus says, is if it doesn't work, finally, if that person will not listen to the church, treat that person as though they were a pagan or a tax collector. Now, what does that mean? It means these are the prime targets for evangelization. You redouble your efforts. I mean, that's how Jesus thought about pagans and tax collectors. You know, they weren't the scum of the earth to be ignored. They were the field ripe for harvest. I mean, this was where you really concentrate. So if you identify that that's where a person is, then you try all the more to love them back into the kingdom. But being clear that there are certain, you know, boundaries here and general frames of reference that have to be observed. Yeah. I'm going to get to the bottom line.
Ah, okay. This is a suggestion. How many of you like to pull weeds? Quite a few. Okay.
Sick.
A few like to pull weeds. The suggestion is that the way that the parable unfolds is that the weeding is really God's job. That it's not our job.
Were you talking literally or figuratively?
Right. I guess I'm in a figurative mode. Yeah. The job of gathering in the harvest is God's job. And part of our task is to let the harvest grow and not to be oblivious to the weeds and not to be and not to lack on our analysis of the weeds, you know, to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves, but to be really aware if we're going to go in this rooting out process, if we're trying to solve the problem of the weeds, to really be centered and aware of what we're up to, because we can't ultimately do that, and that's not our task. So our suggestion is that Jesus' parable is summoning us not to be hyperactive about pulling out these weeds, about rousting deadbeats and hangers-oners. It's not to point fingers, but rather it's to plant and to water and to spread the word in season and out of season. And Jesus isn't calling us to make the decision, we use the phrase, who's naughty or nice, right? But rather to ask the question, what can I do to spread the good news?
Yeah, I see the parable as it's an eloquent summons, not as often misappropriated, to get out there and stick it to those evildoers, you know, this is the rallying cry for some kind of new crusade. It's really an eloquent summons to be patient, you know, which takes a lot, in the long run, takes more energy than hyperactively going out there on some kind of weed-pulling binge. You know, the stamina that it takes to be patient, to water, to fertilize, to nourish, and let growth happen so that God can do weeding and harvesting is much, much more important. The parable, I think, is trying to give us a sense of freedom. This is an incredibly freeing parable. Somebody else is going to take care of separating weeds and wheat and doing the harvesting. It frees us from having to worry about having a pure community. It frees us for inviting people.